Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of the Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to a live recording from Roslyn Packer Theatre at the 2017 Festival.
Hello? Good, I'm just checking to see that you can hear me. All right. Before we start, ladies and gentlemen, I think. No, it is literally just my dad. It is my dad. Hello, Dad. Couple of others there. Hello to everybody. Welcome. Before we begin, I just want to acknowledge that we are standing on traditional Indigenous land. We're standing on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and we pay respects to our elders past and present. Well, today is going to be a discussion on feminism, mainly what it means to be a feminist, but also writing for feminists, writing as feminists, and writing to incite change and action. How do we do it? I have no idea. Luckily, the three people up here on the stage with me do, so we're going to be picking their brains. For those of you who don't know me, I forgot to introduce myself. My name is Jan. I host a show on Australia's 17th most popular network. That wasn't a joke. It's called The Feed. Yes, one person knows it. I love you. It's called The Feed, or as my grandmother likes to call it, That Food Show, on the ABC. All right, the ladies up here with me this morning, we've got Clementine Ford, author of The Unapologetic Manifesto, Fight Like a Girl. If you haven't read it, do. Tracy Spicer, author of The Good... author of The Good Girl Stripped Bare, and with me just to my right is Yasmin Abdul-Majeed. who I'm sure you haven't heard of because she has not been in the news at all. all right, we're going to begin. I want to start with a very general question. This is for all of you. You've all written books. I want to know, was there a particular book, a particular feminist book that inspired you the most, that you had a moment when you were reading that you were like, I am picking up what this person is putting down?
Susan Faludi's Backlash. And I can't believe I'm going to get to see her speak tomorrow night, because it showed me that the history of feminism is never linear. It comes in fits and starts, and there's always a backlash. But the good thing is, if there's a backlash, we know we're affecting changes. We're seeing a huge backlash at the moment, so we know we're forging forward. This is a really seminal moment in history.
It's so depressing, because at the start of that book, it sort of starts... to be a woman at the close of the 20th century, what a privileged position to be in, or something like that. And she wrote that in 1991, and the whole first chapter just basically outlines, like, if you took the date out and some of the references, you could be reading a book that was written this year. You know, the fact that part of the backlash then was about feminism didn't really make... You know, feminism had told women that they could have it all, and then upon discovering that they had it all, found that they weren't really happy with having it all, that all this equality was making us really unhappy, you know, that we were struggling in our homes and our work, and that actually what we all really wanted was just to get married and have babies, and I mean, all things that we continue to hear now as well. So it's sort of very affirming to read Backlash, but at the same time, just really dire.
So true.
Yasmin, yes, do you have one?
Mine was probably Bad Feminist by Roxane Gay, which, I mean, isn't that old, so I guess it sort of talks to how recently my sort of journey around feminism and my type of feminism has been realised. But I think it was the first book that I read that A, spoke to the fact that I really liked terrible music that was super misogynist, but like
it's not Chris Brown, is it?
I mean he's probably one I'm like, oh nah, mate. But I think, I mean, the fact that I get to sort of be at a festival where she's also speaking is incredible. But it was probably one of the first books that I had read that talked to the sort of black woman experience or black female experience as well. And that was something that I hadn't really sort of engaged with. And there is obviously a whole history behind that that I then started to engage with. But and also weirdly, when you said that, the first book that came to mind was or the first character that came to mind was George in The Famous Five, which is like Enid Blyton. And I know that's like, I read that as a child, but if I was to think of like a girl, a female character that I just thought, yeah, I want to be like you and all of the things, that's the first thing that came to mind.
Side comment about Enid Blyton, because I write about this in my book, the dog character is billed above the only female character in a lot of her books. Aww. The dog has a higher billing than the girl. Disappointing.
Oh, but that's not sexism. Oh, come on.
Yeah, come on.
You know, problematic faves all the time.
Also, Enid Blyton was really mean to her kids.
Oh.
All right, that's an interesting side note. Does anybody else have any facts about Enid Blyton that they would just anybody? Like to get out now?
I have gleaned all of the knowledge about Enid Blyton that I pass off as being expert knowledge from a daytime movie that I watched about 5 years ago.
Oh yeah, but can I make
She was not like, a nice woman.
Isn't it, like, so there are lots of male artists that are not nice men that we still laud their art for. So should we judge Enid Blyton's motherhood?
No, we should hate everyone equally.
Yes.
I think it's just, I'm sorry, I'm deviating from obviously from your next question here.
No, no, go on.
But it is interesting that women are held to this hugely high standard in terms of their moral purity, you know, and that maybe Enid Blyton was terrible to her children because she didn't want to have kids, but was sort of coerced really by the gas of the world that she lived in at the time for that to happen, you know? Maybe women can actually just be as terrible and narcissistic and malevolent and sociopathic as men can be, but we are judged more harshly for it because we're supposed to be the sacrificial caregivers all the time.
Well, it's a nurturing myth, isn't it, that mothers are more nurturing than fathers by our very nature.
Yeah, and well, how could you know, if you're talking about the kinds of men who are accepted as being geniuses who have contributed to art or literature or music or whatever it might be, and their behaviour is excused, not only excused but also formed as part of their genius. They're tortured men, you know, but women, I think, inherently are never really accepted as being geniuses in the first place. So there's just something wrong with them,
you know. Just before I move on to my next question, I did forget to, because I'm an excellent moderator, tell the audience that this is being live streamed as well, and there will be times for questions. We're gonna take about maybe 20, 15 minutes of questions. I should let you know, though, there are two microphones on either side of the stage, both upstairs and downstairs, so if you do want to ask questions, you need to physically lift yourself and go to these microphones. They're just ones just there in front of the exit doors. You'll see them. Again, both upstairs and downstairs. Also, if you do want to get these books signed, any of the books signed, you'll have Tracy and Clem in the Ruth Cracknell room. That is on level one, straight after this session. Yasmin has to disappear to another session, but if you do want to get your book signed by Yasmin, that'll be at 12:30, Pier 2 and 3. Okay, good. Moving along. The one thing that I realised was a very big commonality in all of your books was this idea of bodily acceptance. Clem, for you, you talk about having an eating disorder very young in life, age 12. Tracy, you're talking about, you know, being in television and what is required to be in television and also what happens to the body after you have a baby and what that means. Yasmin, I think there's a funny anecdote in your book where you talk about being at a school camp and somebody saying, aren't you hot, you need to wear shorts? And so you go and you buy a pair of shorts and it's like, probably the first and last pair of shorts that you bought, maybe.
I still have them.
But there's this idea of really accepting what it is that you look like and how it is that you present to the world. Why do you think that theme was so prevalent throughout all of your books in such different ways?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think my journey of bodily acceptance or body acceptance is slightly different as well because the people that I tried to model myself off were weirdly guys. So I was like obsessed with lifting weights and being really strong and, you know, bulking, which is like the total opposite end of the spectrum from the rest of my female friends. And that's kind of how I ended up, or that's probably a reflection of the fact that I ended up hanging out with a lot more boys, being in environments that were mostly male dominated and trying to kind of model my what strength looked like. And the reason I think for me where that came from was strength was the only difference that I could see between men and women when it came to strength was physical strength. So I thought, if I became as strong as guys, then there would be no difference, right? And I could be as equal as them in society, right? Because the only thing they can do better is lift things, right? So I'm going to be a 12-year-old that bench presses, which is what I did, right? I got the bench press record at school. It was a whole scene, right? And then all of a sudden, they, like, got hormones and started growing faster. And I was like, no, don't. But it was quite bizarre because that kind of coincided with different expectations from family members, for example, who, you know, my family being sort of Sudanese Egyptian and having a traditional kind of view of what it meant to be, to look like a woman and to dress like a woman and to act like a woman. And that, you know, me being a bulking 13-year-old did not fit with that at all. And kind of that tension between what it meant to look like a woman and what I tried to sort of fit into meant that, I think, I mean, it's no surprise to anyone in the room that your body image and your figure is what you present to the world, and women obviously have a much higher expectation and pressure around that. But I think we all kind of deal with it in different ways. And also, I started wearing the scarf when I was 10.
Yeah, so, and that's another element that kind of, that, so that is part of, you know, your body image, I suppose, and how you present.
Well, it meant that nobody actually saw my body. So the only person that was judging me to the world was myself, which in a way was good because nobody could say anything apart from, like, you're wearing a tent. But the flip side was, you know, I had no real gauge as to what was real and what wasn't because I couldn't actually physically see myself next to anyone else. It was what I saw in the mirror and then what I went out to the world to see. And everything about me looked different. I went to a Christian high school, so I wasn't white. I had hairy legs. Like, nobody in my family talked about this concept of, like, shaving or waxing. So I was like, how do they grow with no hair? Like, I don't understand.
Tracy, your experience is kind of the polar opposite of that. You had everybody, well, looking at your body, so to speak. You're on television. Whose phone is that?
Ooh, naming and shaming.
It's your dad.
What's that?
I said it's your dad's.
It's my dad. What was that like for you, and how did that sort of affect you as a person, and your writing?
Television is at the real pointy end of the appearance penalty and the appearance benefit that women suffer and experience throughout their whole lives and historically. We've always been valued for our appearance more than our abilities or our brains. In fact, I was saddened to see an Our Watch survey a couple of months ago that showed only 1 in 6 girls believes they're valued for their abilities or their brains over their appearance. So we've come a long way, but we've got a long way to go. With my own experience in television, I internalised a lot of that misogyny. So after being told for years that, you know, you're porking up, why don't you go for a run? I want 2 inches off your hair and 2 inches off your ass. And then as I got older, realizing that my currency was depreciating because I was primarily being valued for what I looked like, despite the fact that I'd done a journalism degree and been a journalist by this stage for 25 years, I really saw that media, with not only reflecting and shaping society, that I was contributing to this damaging role modeling to young girls by sitting up there on a news desk and appearing effectively like a Barbie doll, which is why I did the TEDx talk, wiped off the makeup, sprayed the hair, took off the constrictive corporate dress to say this is not the way women should be viewed and valued in society. I actually love one line in Clem's book about this, that, and it's right towards the end, it spoke to me so powerfully, that girls should not be the decorative flowers in the hallway of life. I've now got a 10-year-old daughter and I hear the same kind of comments being made to her that were made to me throughout my whole lifetime, and it infuriates me.
What could you, I'm interested to know what you feel you could have done back then. And is there a part of you that looks back at that and says, you know what, I made the right decision then to go along with all of this because it got me to where I am today. It helped me with my career. It advanced whatever it is that needed to advance. Like, is there a part of you that says, I did make the right decision?
No, I spoke up occasionally. I remember one time I questioned the way an intro was written. It was actually racist. It was appalling. I was 24. It was my first full-time job, newsreading in television. And I was told, you're not paid to think, girl. You're paid to read the auto cue. And I should have taken that further to a more superior person in the workplace. But because I was afflicted by the good girl syndrome, I thought, I can't. I have no power. I should just be sitting here being decorative. So, yeah, I wish every day I had spoken out earlier. I'm glad I spoke out when I did, but I regret not speaking out all the time.
I mean, the system does punish people that speak out.
Yes.
Right? And so you end up being someone, if you're someone that notices these things, weighing up, well, should, as an individual, do I speak out and then cop the individual cost, but hopefully make a difference to the system? Or do I kind of not say anything, get to a point in the system where I have enough power that I can start changing things, but have to accept a whole lot of things along the way? And it's a negotiation.
It's totally a negotiation.
And it's like, I see this a lot with like women in male dominated industries. It's like people will say, this is the line that you have to draw right at the beginning. I'm like, most girls will never get a job if the first day they walk in, or most women won't get a job if the first day they walk in, they say, these are all the things that I think you should change. Because they'll be like, well, we can find somebody else then, right? But that's not fair, right? And it's this weird kind of having to figure out what works for you.
Well, this is the problem that, you know, it's one of the reasons why you have to differentiate between male misogynists and women with internalized misogyny who are doing the work of the patriarchy for it. Because as frustrating as those women can be, they're also, you know, we're all negotiating our way through the system that we live in and trying to figure out a way to be the least traumatized by it. Or to negotiate the least trauma for ourselves. And some women will never come to what I think is the correct thinking on this, but or the more liberating thinking, but some women will at some point. But, you know, we've probably all at some point been in that mindset, unless you've been fortunate enough to grow up in an incredibly feminist household, which I was not. I mean, it was sort of like just a normal kind of household where I was told, well, women can do anything. But I wasn't told how the world would make it impossible for me to do anything. So we kind of all have made those negotiations at some point. But I feel like we've had that experience that you had, Tracy, where it's so hard for us to look back and go, well, I did what was right for me at the time, and so I don't regret anything because now I'm at this point. Because in fact, actually, what you do is you look back and you feel sick that you had to, like, suck up so much bullshit. You had to play the good girl, you had to be nice, and you had to do things that really compromised not just your integrity, but that forced you to be complicit in the widespread idea that you were not good enough. And that to look back and recognise that is not only, you know, deeply disheartening and painful, but it also makes you mourn for the life that you didn't have for those numbers of years. I sometimes feel like when we have panels, you know, of women talking about feminist issues, that there should be like a kick bag in the corner. So you can just, sometimes when you both were talking, I just wanted to go off and like kick the shit out of something. But the other thing with the body stuff is that, you know, I was also thinking when we're listening to both of you speak, is that not only are a lot of these issues obviously universal for not just women, but anyone who feels like they sit outside of what the system tells them that they should be. You know, when I was growing up, one of the reasons why I had an eating disorder was, you know, because we were all sort of instructed to make ourselves as small as possible in order to be, you know, in order to apologise for our existence. But I also just constantly felt like I was not a... I'm going to tread carefully here because I understand that these issues are really difficult for and different for people from trans and gender diverse backgrounds as well. So I'm not laying claim to any of that kind of dysmorphia. Sorry, that was the wrong word for me to use. I didn't mean that. I meant dysmorphia for me. That I never felt like I properly occupied the state of womanhood that I was told that I had to. So I tried to starve myself to be small enough for it. I always felt like I was tall and unwielding and, you know, elephantine, that I would never be properly accepted as a woman. So I kind of swung between these different identities of trying to carve out what that meant, and then eventually just sort of thought, well, I'll just, like, try and shrink myself until people don't notice that I'm there. So the other problem with that, I think, is that these issues are so universal, and yet at the same time, in the way that women are forced to think of the issues that matter to us as being frivolous, sometimes the discussion of issues like body image feels, you almost have that kind of like feminist cringe about it.
It feels like pop feminism.
Yeah, it feels like, oh, it's just, you know, a bunch of women sitting on stage talking about their bodies.
But actually, it's really funny you mentioned that, because I had this down as a question. I'm like, oh, don't ask a bloody body image question. But then it was just so prevalent in all of your books in really different ways that it was asking itself, sort of thing. So there's obviously something there that very much affects, I would say, close to every woman in some way, you know. So I think
and that's the thing, is that one of the other tricks that has been played on us by patriarchy is the idea that our concerns are irrelevant and meaningless.
Yeah.
So if we're all sitting here feeling deeply concerned about what our bodies say about our right to exist, then it's not a reflection of the world that teaches women that they only have one value, or that their value is limited to the, you know, the sort of classic quote about our prettiness being the rent that we pay to exist in the world, but that it's actually more a reflection of how frivolous we are, and that's why we don't achieve success and power, because we're so fixated on stupid, irrelevant details like how we look and tabloid magazines and fighting with each other, and women are each other's own worst enemies, and you'll never find anyone bitchier than a woman, etc., etc. The worst bosses I've ever had were women. All of these things that we constantly hear to try and convince us that actually it's not an oppressive umbrella that we live under, but it's really just us holding ourselves back.
Mm. I want to talk a little bit about sort of taking action and making change, particularly, use the term loosely, the 21st century. It's 2016. But do you see a difference between the way we fight now, and I want to kind of bring the online space into this as well, is there a difference between the way we fight now and try to affect change comparative to what it was in the 2000s and what it was in, you know, the 60s and 70s? What is there a difference for you guys?
Well, I mean, so my fight would be in the last, I would say, 5 to 7 years.
Yeah.
And so that's largely been, if not online, if not all online, then mostly online. But I think it's interesting in that, like, the online space doesn't necessarily mean it's a different fight per se. It just means that the tools are different, and then the exposure is different, and the reach is different, and the way that you are traumatized by it is exacerbated, or the way that I explain the sort of online space and the effect that it has is that it just amplifies everything exponentially, right? So the highs are much, much higher. You can reach millions of people with your message, and it's amazing, and you can go viral, and all of a sudden you've got people in Tunisia and the United States and Iceland emailing you and being like, oh my God, I loved your TED talk or what you did, or, you know, can you, and you connect with all these people around the world. The flip side is that you then also have millions of people telling you very, very personally how much they want to kill you, or want to rape you, or want to behead you, or want to stone you, and you get that on a daily basis, and then you get that in your Twitter, in your inbox, in your on your Facebook page, and any person with any thought around the world can tell you that thought, right? And so it essentially just means that you have to navigate so much more noise, right? And you are much more an individual fighter as opposed to part of a collective, I feel. It's a little bit more difficult to feel like you're part of a collective when the hate is directed at you very, very individually, and right, you're dealing with it very, very individually. And I'd be curious as to your thoughts on this, and whether you've seen that change over time, or whether that's simply just a function of, like, the world that I inhabit. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the fragmentation of the mass media has meant a revolution in the empowerment of women and girls, but an equal and opposite reaction, which is the vile backlash that you're talking about there, Yasmin. And again, we've got to look at this. Historically, women have been silenced from the time of Homer's Odyssey, where Penelope was told speech will be the business of men, mm-hmm, and all this, you know, shrill and whiny women's voices. So as we have more diversity in voices on our media platforms, particularly online, we're also seeing a huge rise of the men's rights movement to battle against us. So I'm incredibly torn in this area. I see both sides of it. I think I'm a glass half full kind of gal. I think that right will win. But with regards to your question to it being a tool for us to fight, I think it's a tremendous tool. We just need to learn how to protect ourselves and do it properly.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and I bear in mind the younger girls who, you know, are kind of coming up now, they will have existed kind of purely in this online space. And for me, one of the real key issues I see, particularly with young girls, is things like revenge porn and, you know, the intense shaming that happens online. And it, I wonder, yeah, did you want to say something?
I heard a much better expression for what, you know, is collectively known as revenge porn, and that being image-based abuse. You know, it's funny, again, it's not, I'm not saying anything that probably anyone in this room hasn't heard, but we've all heard that argument about the moment that it appeared to be a problem that men were getting drunk on Oxford Street and being punched and killed, that it changed from being a king hit to a coward punch because we wanted to reflect what the, we wanted to reflect in the language the gravity of the situation. And yet all of these phrases are used to describe abuse that's done against, performed against women, and it's still kind of, I mean, revenge porn is like, it's quite a titillating title, isn't it? So I think that there is there is value in changing the language around that. But you're right, and the thing is that, you know, people often respond to, Yasmin, I'm sure that you've had this experience as well, oh, we'll just get offline.
Oh my God.
If you people just say to me things like, you've got to go to the police with that. And I'm like, well, what do you say? Are they going to do something about it now when they didn't do it the last 50 times that I went to them?
There's like nothing like going to a police station and being like, hey, I've got like 50 death threats on Facebook. Can you help me? And they're like, no.
Yeah. I mean, legally they have to,
but they don't necessarily have the capacity to deal with that.
But right. the thing is when they say things like, you know, when the wizards tell you to get offline, you know, just get offline. It's not real life anyway. All these people online, it's not real life. Firstly, the online world is every bit as real to people as the offline world. The fact that businesses cannot survive without a Facebook presence shows that to be true. But also, we're now part of the generation of people who have never known a world without the internet. And we will soon have a generation of people who have never known a world without Facebook or Snapchat or Instagram or whatever. I don't know what platform the youth are using these days. But,
So it's
disingenuous, and it's just passing the problem off as something that doesn't need to be focused on to say that, you know, we have a real problem with image-based abuse and violence and threats and, you know, sexual taunts and harassment being perpetrated against girls primarily, and I mean young girls, by boys who have not been properly educated or reprimanded about the fact that, yes, these two worlds are exactly the same and that they can't just get away with bullying and really kind of, it's the kind of bullying that follows you into your home and follows you into your essence.
I mean, one line that I like to say, or that I've sort of referred to, is like telling people to go offline is like telling them to get off the streets, as it were, right? It's a way to silence yourself. It's a way to say, become invisible, don't participate in our public spaces. Like, you are responsible for your own protection, right? It's not everybody else's responsibility to sort themselves out, but it's actually your responsibility to make yourself a smaller target.
And it's part of
that silencing. And I think, and also, it's so time consuming.
Yes.
Right? Dealing with online abuse is so time consuming.
Do you have a strategy? What's your strategy?
I've just gotten other people to help me do it because I literally get thousands, like, you know, particularly if I'm on front pages, people.
Which you've never been.
Never. I don't recommend it if you have a choice. Just be like, nah, mate, I know. Or just make sure the only photos are, like, anyway. It just, like, there's, I think it's a Toni Morrison quote that talks about racism being a distraction, right?
Yeah,
so you don't
such
have
a great
to
quote.
Focus on the, I think it's the same thing. I think all of this sort of online abuse in particular is a distraction from actually dealing with the systemic, patriarchal
society. I'm just
going
to look that quote up now.
Yeah, so just make sure.
Yeah.
because it just means that I spend all my time dealing with people that send me abusive things and helping and trying to cope and also trying to sort through the trauma of having people send me photos of which guns they want to kill me with, right? And so that becomes my life rather than actually fixing the problems in the world.
Yeah.
And it's so wrong. I'm sorry, but I really feel for what you've been going through, Yasmin, because it exemplifies how silencing women and telling them to get offline takes away the tools required for them to do their job. It's another way of not only silencing women but forcing them out of the workplace as well.
I'm just going to read this quote.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's the function, the very serious function of racism is distraction. It keeps you from doing your work. It keeps you explaining over and over again your reason for being. Somebody says you have no language and you spend 20 years proving that you do. Somebody says your head isn't shaped properly, so you have scientists working on the fact that it is. Somebody says you have no art, so you dredge that up. Somebody says you have no kingdom, so you dredge that up. None of this is necessary. There will always be one more thing.
Wow. That's
a great quote.
This goes on forever. I want to talk about boys, and not because I want to talk about boys, but because I want to talk about girls. And I say this, Tracy, because I know that you have young children and they have often hear the term feminazi bandied about by young boys. And I wonder, what do you say to them in terms of how to deal with something like that? What do you say they should, how they should respond?
I do hope this will be the subject of my next book, because I live in an outer suburban area, and I probably shouldn't admit this, but I live in Tony Abbott's electorate, right? So it's pretty darn conservative, as you would well imagine.
But it must feel good voting against him.
It feels so good, I can tell you. It feels almost weaponised. So I have a boy and a girl who are 10 and 12, and my husband and I are feminists, even though my husband likes to refer to himself as an equalist. And we're kind of outliers in our community. I hear pretty horrific things being said by the groups of boys and a lot of internalised misogyny by the girls. I hear the boys, if another boy wants to read a book instead of running around in the playground, he must be a sissy. So there's awful homophobia in our school grounds, I'm here to tell you from the front lines. And about girls, I hear terrible, terrible stuff silencing them. The boys are putting up their hands more in the class than the girls. The girls are taught to be good girls, to sit there, cross their legs, be the glue in the boys' conversations. So with my boy and my girl, for the last 5 years, so probably from when they're about, you know, 5 and 7, we've been calling out sexism every single day. We talk about it in the lounge room. We talk about it in the car when we're listening to talkback radio. We talk about it when we're watching a film that's got more male characters and the girls are playing the romantic roles. We talk about it with regards to chores. I was devastated when my son, who used to love cooking, said to me 2 years ago, I don't want to cook anymore, and when I move out of home, it's okay, Grace will cook for me. Because all of the boys, like he's at that tween age where he's more influenced by his mates' opinions than our opinions, thought it was not cool to do cooking. So 2 years ago, we instituted one night of cooking that our son would look after and one night of cooking that our daughter would look after. I was devastated that even in our own household, we were seeing this misogyny. So we talk about it every day is the answer.
What is there anything that you tell your daughter in particular in terms of how to deal with somebody saying feminazi or slurs? I know you talk a lot about this in your book as well, Clem, but is there any advice that you give to her?
Oh, she calls it out, and my son calls it out in the playground too, which is tremendous.
Your son has started calling it out then?
Oh, yeah. My son is really powerful at calling it out now, and I think that's wonderful because that's where the conversation's got to go next. We've said for years, tell your daughters to call it out. My daughter's incredibly feisty. She calls it out all the time. That's not right and that's sexist, she'll say. And then she'll explain why, because I've given her some historical language and context to around it. It's so much fun being in my household, you know.
She just like quotes Andrea Dworkin every now and again, you know.
I'm embarrassed to admit she gives speeches about the suffragettes, and actually I'm proud to admit it. I shouldn't say I'm embarrassed to admit, but it is a source of amusement for the other parents. It's like, wow, your daughter taught us about Rosie the Riveter, and I'm like, yeah.
Okay, in terms of, because I know you talk about something that's like recapturing the centre, like trying to make feminism accessible. How do we feel about that? How do we feel about trying to sell feminism to people who, men and women, who might not necessarily be on board with feminism? That's something that I think different people sit on different sides of the equation on. So, Clem, I'll start with you.
Well, my policy and stance on it is pretty clear and set now, which is that I'm not going to reward any man for, you know, showing a vague, half-hearted interest in feminism. I mean, it's with respect to your children, Tracy, and your parenting of you and your partner, I think it's great that your son's calling out sexism, but we know that the way that things are, he will be rewarded for that in a way that your daughter is punished. And he may be, at the moment in school, he may be teased by his peers, but at some point, men who speak out against gender inequality and men who kind of occupy a tiny, like, foot in the feminist dialogue are celebrated in these ways that, you know, they don't get rape threats sent to them. They don't get photographs of guns that will be used to put them in a grave. You know, Karl Stefanovic wears the same suit every day for a year, and not only does no one pick up on that, but afterwards they're like, wow, what an amazing guy. Isn't it so great that he did this experiment for a year? He's just wonderful. I think that we have to address that need that we still feel we need to have as, you know, collectively as women, to offer cookies and rewards and gratitude for what should just be basic decency, you know? And men who have grown used to expecting that kind of praise need to start reckoning with the fact that they don't deserve it and start sitting in the discomfort that they might feel by doing the right thing and not being acknowledged for it.
I mean, it's a total reflection of the power structure, right? In the sense that any group that's a minority that advocates for the rights of a minority, the individuals will be punished, whether that's Indigenous or people of different colour or whatever it might be. If you're advocating for your rights and you don't necessarily have those rights, you will be punished. And so I think the conversation for me isn't necessarily, it's something that I've been trying to work through recently, but it's actually less about how individuals deal with it and more about trying to remind us that we are in a system that is oppressive,
yes.
A system that is patriarchal, a system that makes us all like fight each other for scraps when we really need to be thinking about how do we change our institutions and our structures and our power dynamics so that we are fundamentally equal. And that's a much more difficult discussion.
Mm. And even the people who, specifically looking at the system of sexism, even the people who are best placed to be beneficiaries of that are still harmed by it, you know. And at some point they might turn into, you know... The whole not all men thing is a joke, and I don't think that we should engage with that. There should be no reassurances to anyone that, of course, not all men, because it should just be taken as read. And again, it's just a distraction that these things are the things that we tend to focus on. But of course not all men perpetrate abuse and violence. Of course not all men are conscious of the misogyny of the system that we live in, but they are all beneficiaries of it, particularly if they are white men.
Yes.
And that needs to be understood by them. But also, you know, to hear the story about, like, the little boy sitting in the playground who's teased because he's sitting there and reading a book and not doing what boys should be doing is also heartbreaking, because toxic masculinity creates, prisons for men to rest in as well, where they can't be their fully formed, complex humans that they should be able to be because of the conditioning that they're subjected to as well. And, I remember a few years ago, a man sort of in outrage wrote a comment on something that I'd written about how we needed to start teaching boys and men not to sexually assault women, as opposed to teaching women the sort of age-old message of how we can modify our behaviour to prevent it. And he sort of said in outrage, oh, this is just ridiculous. How do you expect... He was talking about in Australia. How do you expect to educate 11 million boys? And I was like, well, exactly the same way that you assume all the time that you can educate 11 million girls. And the problem is that no one is comfortable,
yes,
with a system in which boys are told what they can and can't do.
It's so true. Or that boys are encouraged to be, in inverted commas, feminized. You know, we tell our girls it's okay to be tomboys, but boys aren't allowed to, you know, men aren't allowed to go into nursing or teaching, or we put them down. Boys aren't allowed to be encouraged to do things that girls do because that's valued lesser than what boys do. With regards to reaching the centre, I think it's important to break down neurosexism, because a lot of people still believe in this the theory that's been roundly debunked by Cordelia Fine with Testosterone Rex, among other authors, that boys are one way and girls are another way and we're hardwired to be that way, I think it's bullshit. And the only way to change that neurosexism is to reach into the lounge rooms of the regional and rural areas and the suburbs where a lot of this theory still exists and explain that there are structures in society we need to break down. It's not just individual men and women. We've got to take a crowbar to the whole system.
I've got a couple of questions from the live stream coming up, and this is just a reminder that we'll be taking questions after this question here from the live stream. So if you do want to ask any of the ladies questions, remember just to make your way over to the microphones that are now no longer there. Excellent. Where did those microphones... Oh, they are? Oh, okay, very good. The bright light's in my face. Yeah, they are. They're just right there next to the two exits. So if you do want to do that, make your way over. And for the nobody people sitting up... Okay, anyway. All right, here we go. One of the questions that's come through the live stream, as we said, negotiation is a vital step to making changes in the real world. So how do modern women compromise wisely? Compromise.
Look, I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all thing, and I think it's something that I personally have tried to be generous in, because I understand that it's a different fight for everyone and different people have different capacities and different requirements. Like, it's very easy for, and you may both disagree, but it's very easy for me to say, you know, you must say all this and this and this and you may lose your job, but it's fine, don't worry about it. But if you're a woman who's low socioeconomic, if you're a woman who can not get another job or you need to support your family because you're a single mother, like, some of these things are not really practical for your life. And you do then decide to compromise, and you do then decide to participate in the system because you need to survive. And I think there is actually an onus on people that can, that have the capacity and have the freedom and have the, you know, economic cushion and have the political capital and have the social capital to actually make less of a compromise, to make the compromise easier for those who may have less capital, if that makes sense.
It's so true. It's so true. That's an incredibly wise comment. I was able to take the action that I did as a white middle-class woman in a workplace from a position of privilege. I had earned enough money to be able to afford a lawyer. I had the emotional support of my family, and I had come to a point in my career where I thought, do you know what? If that's it, that's it, that's fine. You know, hopefully I can rebuild, but if I don't, I've had a nice career and that was great. I really feel for a lot of the young women who I mentor, a lot of them from different cultural backgrounds, from low socioeconomic areas, because I say to them, the structure of the system is against you. I would like to empower you to fight by giving you the tools, the research, the practical help if you do choose to fight, but I understand if you don't, because, you know, you're coming at it from a really, really difficult position within society. So I agree with Yaz, it's on a case-by-case basis. I mean,
one way that I've seen it done, or that I've tried to do it, and it's not perfect because it kind of uses the existing system, is to go through people, or to essentially borrow power from others that are more powerful than I in order to achieve something. So it's finding, you know, somebody in, say it's in a corporate, finding somebody in a higher position who understands where I'm coming from or understands the challenges that I'm personally facing, and they advocate on my behalf so that I then am able to get to a certain level and can have a conversation. And I mean, it's not perfect. And again, I come back to this thing of, we're all existing in this box that is defined for us, right? And all we're doing is kind of shifting the sand a little within that box. And until we start, you know, essentially dismantling that box, where it's all a little bit piecemeal.
Clem, is it a case-by-case basis, or do you think that there is universal advice that can apply?
No, I think it's definitely case-by-case, and everyone's circumstances are informed by the particular kind of swirl of what influences that they're stuck in, you know, and some people may have families that they don't have a choice but to stay in a situation and support. The frustration for me is when you see women who have achieved a certain amount of power. Obviously, they don't have the same amount of power as their male colleagues generally, but they've definitely achieved a certain amount of power, and yet they still seem, at least outwardly, to be expressing complicity with you know, it's that kind of like, well, I've never experienced sexism in the workplace. And you're like, well, you work in the media in Channel 9, so of course you have.
Yes, I
don't worry. You know, I know that the walls are listening, but...
I've never experienced sexism at SBS. Just let that one be on the record.
But I think that sometimes as well we have to... I mean, it's really important to acknowledge as well that when we are making judgments... Women shouldn't be free of being judged by other women because we shouldn't express support for each other just because we're women. Of course, that's ridiculous. But at the same time, we have to be conscious that we've internalised this idea that there's only a certain amount of power for women. And of course, within that tiny box of power, women who have the most privilege have access to most of that power. So yes, that needs to be dismantled and redistributed in a more diverse and equitable way. But it doesn't have to just be done in that tiny little box of power that women have been kind of given off on the side. Like, the whole system needs to be dismantled. I don't have any answers for how to do that, by the way.
Yeah. Well, that was my next question.
But I think that we can... One of the really clever things that living in a patriarchy over, you know, multiple generations has done to us is to see other women... And this is distinct from being that women are each other's own worst enemies, but to make us believe that the competition rests with other women as opposed to the much bigger system that we live in.
It's like if power was a table with 10 seats and we're like only given one seat and we all have to fight for the one seat, it's like actually no, we can take as many seats as we want.
Yeah, we could take 9 seats if we wanted to.
We could.
But, and also we kind of have to be careful about... it's really easy, particularly in kind of like online spaces, to fall into the trap of expecting... When you don't kind of balance out the fact that people, by virtue of the fact that they also have to survive in the world, have to make compromises because, as you said, again, to feed their family or to make sure that their bills are paid or to make sure that they don't end up on the street, whatever it might be, that... We mustn't apply a lens of moral purity to people that we're not willing to apply to ourselves. That if we are not willing to challenge and question our own compromises that we make, we can't decide that other people's compromises are blanketly make them an evil person.
I might just go to some questions very quickly because we are running out of time. So we'll take the first question on this microphone over here. Oh, hello.
So being a year 8 boy, I hear a lot of sexism and rape jokes that enforce rape culture every day in the school field. What can I do to, I don't know, call it out or help stop it?
I have a really good response to that, and I'm so glad you asked that question. One of the big fears that people have, whether or not they're in year 8 or whether or not they're 38 years old or 58 years old, people are always afraid of challenging their peers because it can make things uncomfortable for them or they can face backlash. Like, that's a normal emotional human response to be worried about how you do it. And one of the most effective ways, if you want to do it gently, is to ask them to repeat the joke. There's two different things you can do. One is, can you repeat that joke? I didn't hear it. And then ask them to repeat it again. So, or if it's a comment or something, because it's something like they'll repeat it the first time and then the second time you say, can you repeat that again, please? Then they realise, actually, I shouldn't be saying this. And then they start to sit in their discomfort. But you haven't done it in a way that will necessarily cause harm to you. The other thing that you can do is say, I don't get it. Can you explain it to me?
These are great tips.
They're really good tips.
It's tremendous advice.
If you're not in a position where you feel like you can safely for yourself, because it may be unsafe for you to be like, I don't like what you're saying, and schools can be really hostile environments, then those are really effective ways that you can kind of open up a conversation as well. And so if they say, well, why? If you say, well, can you explain why it's funny? You know, if they say like, she should get the classic kind of hilarious comedy that's often spread around online. She should get back in the kitchen and make me a sandwich. Can you explain why that's funny to me? And then whatever conversation is prompted by that, they may shut you down as well, but you may also be able to actually start a dialogue and say, okay, so do you think it's funny if someone said that about your mother? I mean, generally speaking, I don't think that we should fight sexism by just characterising women as being someone's mother, sister, daughter, etc. But it can be an effective way. It's one of those compromises, I guess, that you make. It can be an effective way to start that conversation. But, you know, just good on you for wanting to stand up against it. And I would also urge you to find some compatriots in the girls in your class, because it's really important, whether or not you're a boy or a girl or someone who sits anywhere on that spectrum, it's really important to have solidarity with people and to have a tribe of people who will back you up and also will be your safe space where you don't have to continually justify your frustrations or continually justify the things that you know that are really going on, but other people will gaslight you about and will say, well, you're imagining that, or that's not really happening, or you're just being too sensitive. So I think that that's a really important thing for you to do as well. And I hope you already have that. If you don't, then maybe try and find it, because I bet that there are some girls out there that would love to have your support as well.
And also boys. It's great to seek out other boys who are like-minded to you. And also speaking to teachers as well, because teachers want to know that this is going on in the playground and they can help with some structural assistance. Using humour and anecdote are a great way, as Clem said, of approaching these things and of influencing and changing behaviour. So more power to you.
Do you feel like you got some answers?
Yeah.
Great. All right. We'll take the next question.
Oh, hi. This is... Oh, sorry. Is that...
There's a person?
Oh.
Up on the top.
Oh, up on the top. Got you. Hello. Hello.
As a, like, very privileged, well-educated white woman, when I enter debates about feminism and write about feminism and talk about feminism, of course I want to make sure I'm using my privilege and making sure my feminism's really intersectional and helping women of, you know, all ranges of life. How do I do this without kind of erasing minority voices from the conversation and actually like changing that power balance so I'm not actually helping them but kind of actively silencing them under this guise of inclusiveness?
Great question. I think, so the first thing is recognizing that that's a thing that can happen. So I think you've definitely done that, so awesome. I think the second thing is kind of understanding that it doesn't actually, like, remembering not to center your voice in that discussion, right? And so that means you seeking out information or you seeking out those experiences and stories and trying to understand, I guess, the battles that are different for different women. But then also, rather than you writing about them, right, you finding those voices that are already out there and amplifying them through your platforms, right? And so I think it's really important that it is not your role to translate somebody else's experience. It is your privilege can be used as a platform for amplifying that. And so, I mean, going out there and finding more voices, making sure, like, you know, only reading books written by women of color or articles written by women of color or Indigenous women, if that's what you're interested in, or trans folk, or whatever it is that you sort of decide, okay, this is where I want to use my privilege to amplify. And just remember, it's not about you. It's not about you. And the moment that you start to feel uncomfortable, that's a good thing, because it means that you're learning. It means that you're being stretched. Just sit in that discomfort. Why am I feeling uncomfortable? And if you did something wrong, that's okay. Just accept that. Be like, look, I'm really genuinely sorry. I'm trying to learn, and ask for forgiveness, but don't feel entitled to that forgiveness. Good luck.
Great answer.
Can I just make one little addendum to that? In the same way that we shouldn't tolerate men expecting to be rewarded and praised for just showing up to the feminist dialogue, if you have privilege, like, for using myself as an example, white privilege, class privilege, economic privilege, et cetera, like, you don't deserve any cookies either. You know, just because you've listened to someone doesn't mean that you get to give yourself a little pat on the back. So yeah. Thank you very much for that illuminating response.
I'll take a question over here.
This is a question based on a comment that Clementine made. You said that you grew up in a household where you were taught that women can do everything, but not told how the world will make it impossible for you to do that. And as a parent, how do you convey that message to your daughters without creating fear?
Tracy's got an older daughter than... I don't have a daughter, but...
You go, darling, and then I'll add some thoughts.
Okay, I can only base that on what I wish I had grown up with instead. And that is that I think that my situation is probably familiar to a lot of girls for whom the only barrier to them, probably because of the various privileges that they have, is probably gender. And so the sense that, like, you can grow up and do and be anything is actually... And this is not a failing of my parents, because I think that they're a product of their environment as well. I wish that there had been much more knowledge in general in my house about the privileges that we had and the disadvantages that gender presented, but also how we had lots of things that we didn't earn, that we just sort of, by virtue of being born into a particular situation, we got to enjoy and experience and recognise how we could then kind of work to dismantle that privilege ourselves. And I feel like that would have not only given me a sense of how many challenges the world would pose as a woman, but also would have set me earlier on the path to understanding that the problem didn't begin and end simply with this kind of like broad banner of gender equality, but that it was actually about decolonizing all of history and in not inviting, but actually stepping aside and making room for an equal number of voices. And it's interesting that the title of this talk today, this panel, is called All Girls to the Front, which presumably comes from Kathleen Hanna saying at a punk show, you know, all girls to the front right now. I mean it, come to the front. And I remember posting that on my Facebook page once and receiving a backlash from people saying, you know, well, how's that equality? How is that fair? If you're forcing men to step aside, how is that fair? And I think that what people didn't really understand was that in some ways power is infinite in some things. And then in other ways, there's a finite number of spaces that cannot be... You cannot create a system in which people have gender equality if men are still occupying the majority of positions of leadership. But feminism is about so much more than just having women in positions of leadership, because that's a very capitalist kind of interpretation of it. So to address things like class inequality, you need to completely dismantle systems of capitalist patriarchy, and then to dismantle systems of... like gender identity inequality, you need to move away from the really binary idea that cisgender masculinity and femininity are the only two existences. Of course they're not. You know, there's so many voices. The idea, you know, it's the 50th anniversary of Aboriginal people being counted in the census, and it's still so impossible in this country to have a discussion about not even just the deepest forms of racial oppression, but even the fact that white people still feel oppressed when they're being told that they can't wear blackface to costume parties. There's so much that is inherently diseased and wrong with the system that we live in, and I wish that I had known that so much earlier.
And children are able to take on board this complex information. This is what I've learned by talking to my kids over the last couple of years. I was also brought up with actually a feminist mother who told my sister and I, the world is your oyster, you girls can do anything, you don't have to stay at home and have children, you can have a career. You know, that was the era I was brought up in. That was a huge thing to be able to be in the workplace, let alone succeed in the workplace. Or succeed in society as a woman. So I would say to you, don't rely upon platitudes with children. Never say all or nothing. I'm a real practical feminist. Break it down practically. For example, they have a great STEM stream in my kids' school at the moment. It's a mixed gender school. Yet only 20% of the girls are taking up STEM. So I went up and asked the questions of the teachers, and I found out that it was scheduled at the same time as a dance class, and the girls were being pressurised to go to the dance class, you know, even the girls who wanted to do STEM. So it just took a small scheduling change to get more girls into STEM at that particular school. So talk to your kids really deeply every day about practical changes they can make within their own worlds to break through those barriers once they reach the workplace.
Okay.
Thank you. You are all goddesses.
Oh, I haven't done anything, just FYI. Look, unfortunately, I'm getting a very fiery red screen in my face that is telling me that we have run out of time. I do apologise. I don't think we can take any more questions. I'm very sorry, ladies. I know you've been up there waiting, but we do have to keep to a schedule. So that, unfortunately, is the end of our session, even though I had a page of other things left to discuss. But nonetheless, please thank our three wonderful panellists, Clementine Ford, Tracy Spicer, Yasmin Abdul-Majeed,